Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. I'm excited to introduce Melvin Johnson. He's a historian that has chronicled the life of early Mormon pioneer John Pierce Holly. What's interesting about Mr. Holly is that he joined several different restoration groups. I don't want to spoil too much, but there's going to be an interesting tumble that I knew nothing about prior to this interview, and I'm pretty sure most of you probably haven't either. So that's going to be a fun part of this interview. Check out our conversation. Well, welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm excited to have a wonderful historian. Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
My name is Melvin C. Johnson. My recent book is The Life and Times of John Pierce Holly, A Mormon Ulysses of the American West.
Oh, nice. Well, we're definitely going to be talking a lot about that. And he was, I like that you said he was a Ulysses, because it sounds like he joined several different restoration groups.
He did. He was, and we can thank Will Bagley for the term, recent term, pan-Mormon, moving throughout the Mormon diaspora.
Okay. Well, before we get into John Pierce Holly, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your background?
Sure. I was born on a cattle ranch in Northern California, grew up in, for my sins, in Carlsbad, California. There was the ocean, the sand, the road, my house. Unique background for the time. Went to college at Dixie College in St. George, the only school that would accept me. And two fine professors there, Pansy Hardy, Edna Gregerson, performed the duty then that we know as student success today. They showed me how to do it, how to be an academic, how to succeed at college, and to enjoy learning in and of itself. Went to Utah State, then into the Army for 12 years. I was Army paratrooper in the infantry, and after injury was in the JAG Corps as a legal NCO and investigator. After that, went to Stephen F. Austin, got two graduate degrees, one in history under Archie P. McDonald from that wonderful group from Rice and Louisiana State, a group of professors that came over to Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas, East Texas. After that, my first major history job was with the Texas Forestry Museum. Most people who don't live in Texas think of Texas as John Wayne or Billy Bob Thornton in the Alamo, out on the dusty plains. There are seven geographical areas for Texas. East Texas is 22 million acres of pine and hardwood. It's lumber industry, water, oil, and cattle. So my job was to record the history of mill town logging and railroad East Texas. John Gerland and I created a database. By the time we were done, we had more than 4,000 locations and 80,000 entries. Put it into a very primitive ClarisWorks database, won an American History Award. And while we were doing that, I kept coming across in my research about Mormon millers, sawmillers, grist millers in the Texas Hill Country, which was the frontier at the time, before the Civil War. And by the time I finished that project in 1996, I had moved over to, let's call it, Mormonism and its intersections in the West. Somebody once said that you can't understand the American West if you don't understand Mormonism, and you certainly cannot understand pioneer Mormonism if you don't understand the American West. It's been a chase for narratives ever since.
Well, interesting. Well, yeah, and I do know, maybe I shouldn't ask this question so early, but I know in some of the reading that I did about your book, that you mentioned something about Zodiac. Is that anywhere near where Warren Jeffs' compound is now, or is that a completely different area?
A couple hundred miles away.
Okay.
And nobody should get excited at the word Zodiac in relation to Lyman White in his colony. As you know, he was called by Clayton the Wild Ram of the Mountains. And so all White did was take the word Zodiac in relation for the town and the proto-corporation that they set up to run the community property.
Okay, and I know Lyman White was an apostle.
Yeah, so he was a junior apostle, 1841, when he was appointed. He had been a great war chieftain in the Mormon-Missouri War of 1838. He was a dangerous man when he was willing to defend the church. Carried a cutlass, carried a flintlock pistol. The Gentiles, the non-Mormons of the area, were terrified of him. They truly were. It was one of the reasons he was residing in Liberty Jail with Joseph and Hiram and Parley and the others for treason charges.
Yeah, so we'll get into him in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about, because I know that John Pierce Hawley spent some time with Lyman White, and so we'll talk about how Hawley came to in contact with them and that sort of a thing. So tell us why should we be interested in John Pierce Hawley? Because he's not a person that I'm super familiar with as far as Mormon history goes.
Most folks interested in Mormon history are not familiar with John P. Hawley. But why Hawley is important, so Zenas Gurley, George Miller, and others of that stripe, is that he wrote about his journeys through Pan-Mormonism. He wrote as much as Bishop George Miller or Zenas Gurley, and is unique that he was in the western part of the Mormon world, baptized in Missouri at the age of 11 in 1837, went through all the trials and tribulations. He and his older and younger brother were tasked with trying to save the family cattle herd. By the time it was all over, the young cowboys had 5 cows left. Their dad had been hiding out so he wouldn't be killed by their enemies. They went over to Illinois, as almost every Mormon did, and then up to Montrose, Iowa Territory, across the river from Nauvoo, knew Father John Smith quite well. Smith ordained John as a teacher. And then Lyman White, junior apostle.
Now, John Smith, how is he related to Joseph Smith?
Uncle.
Uncle, okay.
Joseph Smith Sr.'s brother. Lyman White came recruiting in Montrose for the Wisconsin pineries, where sawtimber was being dropped and milled and then floated down the river for the temple, the Nauvoo House, and other building projects. Most people are not aware that even though Nauvoo was not the second largest city in Illinois, it was close to it at the time. And it was a massive building boom in Nauvoo as the European immigrants came flooding in.
Okay, so what you're saying is, as Joseph was building the city of Nauvoo, that he sent Lyman White on a mission to Wisconsin to get wood so that they could build all the buildings in Nauvoo. Is that correct? Okay.
The earlier story is the Nauvoo House Committee, with Apostle White, Bishop George Miller, Peter Hawes, Lucien Woodworth, Alpheus Cutler and others were on the committee, and they were tasked to go to the territory of Wisconsin to locate existing sawmills, purchase them, and then begin the program of making lumber and timber for the Temple House and other projects. That began in 1841. It was not a good start. George Miller was drafted because of his business ability. He could be a cranky, irritable person. The only two church authorities that he, religious authorities, that he ever followed closely and trusted implicitly was Joseph Smith Jr. and later after his death, James Strang in Wisconsin and Michigan. He distrusted almost everybody else, not impressed with Brigham Young in the slightest, and would quarrel with Lyman White in their five-year association in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Miller went up to the territory in the winter with James Emmett as guide. Emmett was the great Mormon frontiersman, and I think George Miller became almost as good as he was. Later on, we can talk about those exploits. Miller put the sawmills and the logging fronts on a good, sound financial basis. And by 1843, the spring, it was time to expand the logging and milling effort. So Lyman White went recruiting for people to go to Black River Falls in the area. He recruited the Hollies, Curtises, Ballantines, Moncurs, M-O-N-C-U-R, and others who ended up in Wisconsin territory from Iowa. And there they remained for more than a year, finishing the milling and the lumbering for the effort down in Nauvoo.
Okay. And so this is getting close to the time of the martyrdom, it sounds like. So how did Holly react to that?
Early in the winter of 43 and 44, the federal agents for the Native Americans there got involved and refused to let the Native Americans market their standing timber beyond the contracts they had already signed to the Mormons. In other words, by the spring of 1844, the Black Pine mission was going to come to an end.
So let me make sure I understand that. So it sounds like the Native Americans had some sort of a logging contract with the Mormons in Wisconsin?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the federal agents
put a kibosh on that.
That's right. So the colon.
Why would they do that?
It was a typical frontier myth among the anti-Mormons that Joseph and the leadership were going to ally with the Indian tribes, which would, as Will Bagley liked to call it, make them the warhammer of the Mormons, and they would beat up on all the non-Mormons.
And so this was to not only stop the Indians, but to stop the Mormons as well. It was basically to quash them both, basically?
No, the Mormons.
Just the Mormons?
Yeah. The Menominee were not going to go anywhere. They had no great power as Native Americans. Federal Indian agents just wanted to mess with the Mormons, and they were very effective at it.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Melvin Johnson. Did you know that Joseph Smith was considering moving to Texas rather than Utah? We'll also talk about the pagan prophet.
Joseph has received the letter from the colonists in Wisconsin. He creates the Council of 50. The Council of 50, some of them like the idea of Texas, so they send the pagan prophet, Lucien Woodworth on a mission down to Sam Houston, president of the Republic of Texas.
Why do you call him a pagan prophet?
Well, that's what Joseph called him.
We'll have a transcript out shortly to our subscribers. If you'd like to subscribe and get a transcript, go to gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button. For $10, I'll give you a PDF. For $15, I'll give you a printed copy. You can also do that on patreon.com/gospeltangents. So just go there as well. You can also get past interviews on our Amazon page. Go to amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you should be able to see those as well. Please like our page at facebook.com/gospeltangents, and you can get the latest updates there. Also, check our Twitter updates at gospeltangents.com. Be sure to subscribe on our Apple Podcasts page. Go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents, and you can subscribe on your iPhone or any Android device. So check that out. Now, for more great videos, click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here, we've got some more of our great videos.